you know, they don't even have a garden. If you don't have a garden and you don't have the time for that, you're probably not going to get into wild foods that much. Unless you're big into hiking or, you know, other things that get you out into nature. But it does take a little bit of time and effort and knowledge in order to do this. You can't just wish that you know these plants. You have to know the plants before you can gather them.
And what sort of benefits do you see from the people who are motivated to learn more about wild foods? Is it primarily connecting with nature, or do you think people see some nutritional benefits from eating wild foods versus their domesticated counterparts?
Well, yeah, I have a whole chapter, on why people could be excited about wild foods and how they can fit into their lives. Not only is it a fun recreational activity that you can do on your own, but this is something that a family can do together. Kids are really excited about nature. And we have a problem today that was coined nature deficit disorder. And that's where people sort of don't get into nature anymore because, number one, they don't have time, or they have to watch their kids. And we have all these new laws now about letting your kids roam around. I remember when I was a kid, we were 7 and we were roaming the neighborhoods on our own as a little posse of kids, you know. Today, if you did that, you could be thrown in jail for, you know, child neglect. And so when we were kids, we got to explore nature on our own. There was no supervision. Today, everyone has to be supervised. So this way, the parent can actually get out into nature, enjoy nature themselves while their children are enjoying nature, and do it with a specific purpose. And that directedness actually leads to a much greater understanding and more fun and the pursuit of a general hobby about wild foods that both the parent and the kid can really enjoy. Kids love to eat stuff from nature. And it, surprisingly, they're often more capable of distinguishing unique plant identifiers than the parents are. So there isn't that much of an issue about kids like eating something that they're not supposed to be eating.
Well, and looking at all of the beautiful photos in the book and recognizing myself that, wow, some of these wild plants are growing in my yard. And you mentioned that they're growing in a lot of people's yards and farms and other places as well. I would imagine it would also have potential economic benefit for people if they knew that they actually had some edible foods in their yard they could eat for free that maybe they're composting or throwing in the yard debris rather than bringing into the kitchen.
Yes, the plants that I chose to cover in this book, there are thousands and thousands of great edible wild plants all over North America. And I had to choose certain ones to put in the book. And so this book and my second book, this is just volume one of a series I'm working on, I chose specifically that were all over the place, available to everybody. In fact, we were having a little conversation before we came into the studio, and you said, yes, I recognize the plant that, you know, I've been throwing out all this time, but now I know it's a food. Well, the book is designed so that if you bought this thing, read through it, you would recognize several plants you've been throwing out all your life. You've been passing them, you've been seeing them, recognizing them, but had no idea that they were a food. And now you've got another option with them. Rather than throwing them in the compost, you can actually take them in the kitchen and do something with them. And I try and give you all the details that, you know, would allow you to have a success actually doing that.
At the beginning of Edible Wild Plants, you talk about how the field of wild foods has been in neglect and that there are some landmark books that came out maybe 50, 60 years ago, but there's a real void in terms of making the books user-friendly. Can you talk about what that void is and how your book is filling that void?
Yeah. Yul Gibbons, who some of your older listeners might recognize the name of that. Matter of fact, he was one of the most recognized people in North America because he was on a lot of talk shows. He was on the Johnny Carson show a lot, and he was doing Grape Nuts commercials in the past. So a lot of people knew who Yul Gibbons was. He popularized the field of wild foods, but he was much more than a pitch man. He actually wrote really great books on wild foods. He, instead of just like in some of the so-called field guides that you have today about wild foods, instead of just taking one photograph and having one page to summarize all the information you could possibly have on wild foods, he would write a whole chapter about a plant. And so he really advanced the field of wild foods. A lot of people got into it after he popularized it. And then everybody and their relatives decided, oh, this is an interesting field. I'm going to write a book, even though I know nothing about wild foods. And so everybody would, you know, there's probably 200 books written since him about wild foods where people are just sort of repeating old bad information, poor photographs, single photographs of the plants. And so the field has really been languishing for in need of an educator in the field that could really help people who don't have access to botany, who haven't taken botany classes as they've been growing up, don't know much about plants. And so I felt like the best thing I could do is to make wild foods accessible to the normal human, to actually create a pictorial manual about each of these plants, doing a chapter per plant, just like Yul Gibbons did, only having multiple photographs all the way from birth, you know, all the seedlings, all the way to when the plant is producing seed. So several photographs of that, of the sequence, then doing close-ups of the edible parts at their prime stage of edibility so that people could actually see exactly what they're supposed to be eating. And then if there are any processing techniques they needed to know, you know, I could actually show them that. So it's a very visual educational tool. And I call it a user manual, not a field guide, because it really does show you in a sort of entertaining way and an easy way set for today's audience, how do you go from dirt to plate?
I believe we have a call from Joanne. You're on the air with John Califf.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Califf. I've been under the impression that our water, air, and earth are contaminated with all kinds of chemicals, and I was wondering how could it be all right to eat wild plants anywhere. But anyway, I'll listen to what you have to say. It's a very fascinating subject.
Thanks for the call, Joanne. Well, that's a good question. I was also was going to ask you that as well around, I know sometimes when we're doing, say, like heavy metal remediation for lead contamination in the soil, there people will plant greens because some of the greens will uptake the lead well. Is there some concern around contamination and of soils and that getting into the leafy greens?
Oh, yeah, there's always a concern. I mean, today, there is no escape from contaminants. I mean, planes fly over and they're dumping fuel. How are you going to stop that? So the idea is to make wise choices about where you're gathering. And you can only make a calculated guess about the safety of any particular place. You can see direct contamination. Like, for instance, the worst place in the world to possibly pick is anywhere near railroad tracks. They've been dumping herbicides on railroad tracks every year, sometimes multiple times a year, for 100 years. So that's why nothing grows by a railroad track. But plants are very hardy, and so they will survive near a railroad track. But you know, that is the very worst place to gather anything. Close to high-traveled highways and things like that, you've got exhaust, you've got stuff dropping on the road and washing to the roadside. And so you're basically looking for places that you can guess are relatively safe. So it's really a judgment call wherever you are.
And also, like we were talking about, some of those plants are showing up as volunteers in between the plants in our own gardens at home.
Exactly. And that's probably the best place to gather.
And there's also a photo, I believe, of your garden of mostly wild plants that
all,
you've grown.
All wild plants.
All wild plants.
Yeah, my garden basically is, you know, you turn over the soil, you water, you eat. You know, there's no, I don't plant tomatoes, I don't plant peas. I'm just eating the wild foods that come up.
So you divide the types of foods that in the book into four different categories based on taste. How did you come up with those categories as ways to categorize the wild plants that you talk about?
Well, you know, being a student of wild foods all my life, one of the frustrating things was that whenever I discovered a plant, I had no idea what it was going to taste like. And while it can still be a surprise and fun to discover the flavor of things, I find that if you have somewhat of an idea of what to expect, then it's a little bit easier to manage. So particularly for the bitter plants, because I'm not a bitter lover, although I've come to like it more with time as I've, you know, done my research and stuff. But I'm not a great lover of bitter. But if I know that the plant's bitter to begin with, then I can mentally prepare for sampling it and starting to decide, well, how could I use that so it would be delicious in a meal? And so I divided the plants in the book into what I call foundational greens, which are like, you know, lettuce and spinach, so sort of just very conventional flavors with no harshness at, you know, or no tartness, no sour, no bitter. And then, so we've got foundational greens, then the tart greens, then the pungent greens, and the bitter greens. So there's like sort of four sections. And let me sort of make a, not quite a correction, but we didn't want to go with an elaborate name for each of those sections. So we just said greens, even though they're more than greens. Every one of these plants has a vegetable. The greens are usually leaves. So there could be leaves, there could be flowers, there could be asparagus-like parts, there could be seeds, you know, so there's a lot of different foods there. But if you divide them into sort of flavors, then people can predict sort of how to use them, and they're more likely to come up with something they actually enjoy eating rather than sort of struggling through and, you know, being surprised by everything.
We're talking today with John Kalis, the author of Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate. If you'd like to join the conversation on Health Watch, the number is 503-231-8187. Well, maybe we can walk through a plant from foundational greens, for instance, and talk about what the book would tell us. I know you mentioned lamb's quarters, which you refer to as wild spinach, I believe.
That's correct.
And a lot of the plants that was interesting for me to learn had names that had to do with the animals in domestic farming that were eating them.
Yes.
Like pigweed and lamb's quarters.
Right.
What would the book tell us about lambs, wild spinach, for instance? And obviously it's going to help us identify it. And then does it then tell us how to keep it fresh if we're out hiking, for instance, to get back to home? And what else?
Yes. I cover pretty much all the aspects of, if you're going to do this, how are you going to do it successfully? So if you're going to gather things like wild spinach or other plants, each one has its own unique, like, for instance, transportation technology. I hate to be so technical in just saying that, but for instance, wild mustards dry so quickly relative to other plants that they need special care. So I recommend and actually have a little section in the book about what tools to use that help you to be more successful at this. And so particularly for things like wild mustards, I would take a spray mister with me. I actually have a holster in my belt for a spray mister. So while I'm out there and I'm gathering, I immediately put the mustard into whatever carrying container I have, and then I spray mist it to add moisture to the outside of the plant. So it's not like you have to put the stem in water, but you're actually moistening the whole plant, not unlike they do in the supermarkets. When, you know, you're walking by the produce section, you hear thunder, and then all of a sudden sprayers go on, and they're moistening all of the plants because they actually need that to stay alive. And so that kind of technology I cover in the book, what do you do so you're not coming back to the kitchen with totally wilted greens that everyone would go, well, why am I eating this? You know, you want these wild foods to be just as beautiful and delectable as anything you get in the supermarket, and I show you how to do that.
And so also how to, I'm assuming how to prepare them into the meal as well.
Yes. And also what parts to gather when you're out there. I mentioned earlier about you're looking for the appropriate parts of the plant at the ideal stages of growth to get the best food. And so you really want to be able to determine when that is, because plants are variable and the habitats are variable and the microclimates where the plant is, any particular plant is growing, may be different. You also need to know how to recognize when that plant is worthy of collecting or not. Because a lot of people, when they get a wild food book, they just see the plant and they grab the first plant they find. Well, no one's tending this plant. It's not like farmland where they're watering it, fertilizing it regularly. You, as the consumer, are actually making a choice when you're looking at a plant, whether is that going to be choice and good tasting just by how it looks and where it's growing, or is that going to be like chewing on leather because I'm picking it at the wrong stage of growth or under the wrong conditions.
And it, has there been any research done on whether there is an added nutritional benefit or for eating a wild version of a plant versus eating the domesticated version, say spinach versus wild spinach, for instance?
Well, there has been research done, and I have nutrient charts actually in my book about wild foods, and they tend to be nutrient powerhouses, but I don't like to focus on that. Even though I have a PhD in nutrition, I really think people should be eating foods and not nutrients, if you know what I mean. You should be focusing on diversity and a tendency towards more fresh fruits, vegetables, plant life. You know, I'm an omnivore myself, but I think the whole society would benefit if they're eating more, you know, low on the food chain, more plants. And that adds a tremendous amount of new phytonutrients that we have no idea about. Well, actually, I want to call them phytochemicals, because I think our culture has jumped the gun and they're already calling things nutrients. And the literature is just in the infancy stage about this stuff. You know, but if you listen to Dr. Phil and other people, you'd think that we know everything there is to know about phytonutrients at this point, but we don't. We know they're there, but we don't know how they work or what works better than others. And, you know, they can't, you know, they're having trouble repeating stuff in the laboratory, you know, so we're really at the infancy for that. But cultures that ate more plants and diverse plants and wild foods, not because they're wild foods, but because they were diverse, they, you know, like where the original Mediterranean diet came from, where almost the whole diet was wild, both plant and animal life. The grannies who did most of the food preparation knew anywhere between 100 and 150 wild foods. And they would be incorporating those into the diet every single day, not the 100, but, you know, two or three wild plants would be coming into the kitchen, fresh picked every single day and included in breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And because of that diversity, those cultures that ate those kinds of diets, due to the diversity that's only available if you include wild foods, had almost no cancer, no heart disease, no dementia, lived very, very long, healthy lives.
Could you talk briefly about Wild Food Adventures, your business? I imagine that might be fulfilling some of this knowledge gap around, we've lost this knowledge of our, you know, mm-hmm. You're talking about the Mediterranean grandmother of bringing in these wild foods. Is that part of the purpose of your business, helping people to reclaim that knowledge, or is there some other purpose to it?
Well, there's a variety of reasons that I have the business Wild Food Adventures. And my primary mission is to get people closer to the earth so that they're better caretakers of the earth. Because that's what happens. When you spend more time in nature, you appreciate it more and you're more likely to protect it. But as a recreational activity, and I like to consider this a recreational activity, it's just so much fun. And to be able to teach this to people, a lot of people only learn well when they're being taught by another person. After all, that's how you know, we evolved from, you know, eons ago. It was just word of mouth how things were taught. Now we've got a book because, you know, you can't have a teacher everywhere. But if you do have access to an actual human being that can show you these things, it really helps. It's easier for learning for a lot of people.
Well, let's take another caller. Mary, you're on the air with John Kalis.
Hi, Mr. Kalis. They love the show. My mom is a naturalist, and she teaches the edible lawn in Bloomington, Indiana. But I was wondering if you could address the whole invasive species aspect of this, because around here, you know, Queen's Anne's lace, which is a wild carrot, is considered an invasive species, and there's so many others that we can actually eat and that are beneficial for, you know, bees and birds and us, but they're considered invasive, so we're told that we need to cut them down. So that's my question, and I'll listen to it off the air. Thanks.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually have very mixed feelings about invasive plants because, on the one hand, there are certain ones that take over our natural areas, and those I'm pretty upset about. However, many of those are edible plants that were brought over by our European ancestors because they were food. And, you know, in Europe, a lot of those plants are under control because so many people are eating them. Here, we've got something called Japanese knotweed, and, you know, people are going to great lengths to destroy it with herbicides and everything else. If everybody knew how good it was as a food, same thing with garlic mustard. Garlic mustard is a horrendous weed invading our natural areas. But garlic mustard is probably the most nutritious leafy green that's ever been analyzed to date. And if everybody knew how to eat it and knew how to identify it to pick it in the first place, we wouldn't even have to get natural predators to be, you know, like they do a lot of times. They'll bring in a beetle or something that eats a plant to try and kill an invasive. If everybody knew how edible and delicious these things were, then we would be the control pest, basically, that's eating the weeds. I guess calling us a pest is not probably the best thing to do. But, you know, but if everybody did participate in that, it would be a great thing. In fact, there are garlic mustard festivals in different parts of North America where, like, a park will actually have a festival where they bring in people, they have booths and music and all this kind of stuff, and they actually have people, they teach people how to identify garlic mustard, they go collect it, and then they have cooking contests. And so that way they're harvesting a lot of these plants and cooking them up. It helps the natural area, and people learn about the plant, and then they can eat it from that point on.
So, John, if their interest is piqued after today's program, where can people find the book Edible Wild Plants?
Well, it's pretty much available anywhere. If you buy it from me through my website, then as the author, then I make more money than if you buy it anywhere else. I don't know if any of you are authors out there, but if you buy the book like from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, I'll make $1.25 a book. And if you buy it from me, I make $12.50 a book. So
wow.
It's a tenfold difference.
That's a big difference.
But if you don't have the money, I'd rather have you have the book. You know, so buy it wherever you can afford it. But you can go to my website, and there is an order form you can go to.
And what is your website?
It's wildfoodadventures.com.
And can they also go to wildfoodadventures.com to sign up for classes if they were wanting to take some of your classes?
Yes, we usually have about 22 classes a year, and there's 5 left this year, I believe. By the way, also, even if you buy from Amazon, go through my website and click the link to Amazon, because then I make a few more cents if you go from my website to Amazon. So you should know that about authors. You should, you know, if you can link through, you should always do that, because anything you buy after that, you'll be helping the author out.
Well, it's a pleasure having you on Health Watch today, John.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.
We were talking today with Dr. John Kalis, the author of Edible Wild Plants, Wild Foods from Dirt to Plate, and the founder of Wild Food Adventures. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday Morning Radio Zine. I believe we're heading now from wild plants to an issue about the plight of wild fish. And if you're interested in, if you missed part of today's program, you can go to www.kboo.fm/healthwatch. And later today or tomorrow, this should be available to listen to as a download. Take care.
Hey, 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 got the early Monday morning working blues. I put on my ragged, worn out working shoes. Oh, well, the weekend was too short, but I can't choose. When the Lord made the working girl, he made
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is coming up on 11:30. We just heard Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. Up next is we are going to hear a discussion of the science, sociology, and politics of compassion. Can compassion and compassion training change our physiology for the better? Well, tune in and find out on KBOO, your community-owned and democratically operated radio station.
Does compassion and compassion training change our physiology and our sociology for the better? Three experts join us. James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Paul Gilbert is the head of the Mental Health Research Unit and professor of clinical psychology at the University of Derby. His books include Compassion-Focused Therapy, Distinctive Features, and The Compassionate Mind, Coping with the Challenges of Life. Ian Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kent. He is the author of Suffering, A Sociological Introduction and Anxiety in a Risk Society. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle. I'd like to begin with, what exactly is compassion? James Doty, let's begin with you. What's the scientific basis for compassion?
Let me just preface this by saying that sometimes when this comes up, you could get multiple answers from different people. And in fact, there was a person who said, scientists actually do not agree on what the definition of compassion is. And I will tell you that in a general sense, and one that I think is agreed upon by a number of people, it is the recognition of the suffering of another with a desire to alleviate that suffering. And that's not necessarily to say that one has the ability to or is able to or in fact act. It is simply that they have a desire to alleviate that suffering. And maybe others can comment about what their own definition before I talk about the other aspects of compassion.
Paul Gilbert?
Yeah, I think what Jim's point is exactly what we would see as compassion, this sensitivity to suffering itself and others with a commitment to try and alleviate and to prevent it. In the model that we use, this has two psychologies to it. Firstly is the psychology of willingness to engage with suffering, to turn towards it, to try to understand it, as opposed to dissociating, avoiding, or, you know, turning your back on it. And the second psychology is acquiring the wisdom to be able to do something about it. So an example we give is of compassion is that, you know, if you see somebody fall into a fast-flowing river and you think, gosh, you know, I must jump in and save them. So the first psychology is the intention to engage and put yourself forward. But then mid-jump, you suddenly realize, oh, gosh, I can't swim. Unfortunately, there isn't any action behind it to actually alleviate suffering and so forth. And in the Buddhist traditions, there's that we learn to become enlightened in order to enlighten others. In other words, we spend a lot of time applying ourselves to learn how to alleviate suffering. So intentionality is important, but like with being a doctor or a surgeon, as Jim is, you then have to put in the work to learn what to do. So full compassion is this process of being orientated to suffering, to pay attention to it, to become aware of it, to try to understand it, the nature of it, the causes of it, and then to apply how to create within oneself the wisdom to know what to do. And finally, in our model, we have three, the flow of compassion. There's the compassion that you feel for other people, the compassion that you are open to from other people, so you're open to the helpfulness of others, and there's also self-compassion. So that's how we would see it in the therapy model that we use.
Ian Wilkinson, would you agree?
Put set simply, a feeling for the suffering of others and married to a concern to alleviate their suffering, that's a very good place to start.
I think it was Paul who just said also compassion for the self. So it is perhaps not just for others. Would that be accurate?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think a number of people would argue that, first of all, especially in Western society, we have a tendency to be hypercritical and to ourselves. And that can, and in fact does, have a very negative effect because it creates a self-image that in and of itself is negative. And then as a result, it's much more difficult to, number one, recognize the suffering of others, but also, in fact, to alleviate suffering. So self-compassion certainly is a critical component in the context of understanding one's ability to give compassion and recognize that